I'd like to turn you this evening to the book of Ecclesiastes, and tonight we will read the fourth chapter. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, where Solomon, writing by inspiration, records, "So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Wherefore, I praise the dead which are already dead, more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they, which hath not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbour. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. The fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. Better is an handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he hath neither child nor brother, yet is there no end of all his labour, neither is his eye satisfied with riches, neither saith he, for whom do I labour, and bereave my soul of good? This is also vanity, yea, it is a sore travail. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labour. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished. For out of prison he cometh to reign, whereas also he that is born in his kingdom becometh poor. I considered all the living which walk under the sun, with the second child that shall stand up in his stead. There is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them. They also that come after shall not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and vexation of spirit." May the Lord bless to us and grant us an understanding of his own most holy word. Amen. Amen. In our study of this remarkable book of Ecclesiastes, we have moved on from certain things which Solomon explored and experimented with and proved them to be vain and empty and not the true meaning and purpose in life, to consider another category of factors or forces, which he describes in the sixth chapter, verse 11, as things that increase vanity. Because Solomon began to realize that even though an individual were to determine in his own mind that he would pursue work or riches or wisdom or folly or pleasures or so on in the search for fulfillment and happiness and contentment, yet there were certain contrary forces and factors at play that would prevent the pursuit of those things. And he was doomed to failure almost before he began. Now, Solomon himself was in a most unique and almost unprecedented position to be free of many such limitations or forces acting against him, having almost unlimited resources, being in a position of great political and legal responsibility, having the opportunity to indulge and experiment with these things to the extent that he did. And yet even he found that there were certain things that worked against his pursuit of fulfillment by earthly means upon this earthly stage. And one of the things to which he makes frequent reference in this book of Ecclesiastes might be described as the circularity of existence. Those cycles which exist not only in the natural world, as in such things as the weather and the water cycle and so on, described in the first chapter, but how that in so much of life, in fashions, in politics, in philosophy, in understanding and wisdom, in history, there are so many such cycles where things do not really make progress in any particular direction, but when viewed honestly, when the long view of history is taken, are seen simply to go round and round. And as they do so, as is the case with a circle, to go from one extreme to the other and then back again. And this is what he is expressing in those well-known and, alas, much misused and misapplied words of the third chapter, when he speaks how, in consequence of this, there is a time to be doing a given thing, and there is equally a time when its opposite is done. There is a time of birth and of death, of planting and of plucking up, and so on and so forth. And we considered how distressing this truth must be to the atheistically minded individual who can see no further than this world which is under the sun, and how they must come to realize that they are doomed to repeat the mistakes of history, and that which they are striving to do at a given point or decade in their lives might well be the very opposite of what they want to do in but a matter of a few years' time, and how that they ultimately achieve little or nothing that will last or endure in this world. Indeed, in many ways, it is a blessing if they do not remember history, and if they do forget that which has come before, because it might only increase their distress and their disappointment. That which is now has already been, and it is God which bringeth again that which was past. So it is expressed in Ecclesiastes 3. God has appointed it to be so. And yet this very truth, which must distress the worldly mind, should be understood differently by the child of God. Because, for example, we recognize the seasonableness of God's dealings, that he has appointed a time for every purpose under heaven, that he brings these seasons around, and it is a mercy that he does so, that sorrow should not last indefinitely, that we cannot be permanently bereaved, permanently shocked, and equally not permanently in a state of enjoyment. God works these cycles for a purpose and for good. And indeed, there is a beauty in his dealings. The things which God brings to pass have a beauty all of their own because they are all working his sovereign will and purpose and proceed according to his divine blueprint of time and history. And though the individual components of some machine may be unspectacular to look at in isolation or in abstraction, yet to observe them working together and accomplishing their designed purpose is a wondrous thing indeed. God has indeed appointed the fullness, the fulfillment of a thing in the heart of these various acts and actions. Within the heart of these various affairs and occurrences lies a God-appointed end and purpose. And it is God and God alone who can accomplish things that are beyond this sphere and circuit and round of existence. The works that God makes, the things which God does, are eternal, are lasting. Whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. The means of escape from this round, this drudgery of existence, this cyclical nature of the world, is only through God and through his works. And we considered how with God and with the eternal destiny of the Lord's people, there is to be that time when there is a planting never to be plucked up, a time of laughter and joy that will never give way to weeping and to mourning, a time of eternal joining together and embracing together, never to be separated or passed away. A time of love unbroken by hate, of peace unbroken by war. And these things God does and will do forever in the experience of his people. Now we move on this evening to examine another force or factor which Solomon observed, which militates against the worldly man's plans and prevents the atheist in finding his fulfillment or contentment in things upon the world. And we might describe it in very broad and general terms as this: unfairness. Unfairness. That the world in which we live, and in which the atheist is doomed to find his fulfillment or happiness or pleasures, is fundamentally unfair. That there is injustice, that there is inequity, that there is imbalance, which means things do not occur as he would like them to occur and cannot be relied upon. Because that which he labours to get or to do by just and legitimate means might, because of the unfairness of the world and the inequity which is in it, be taken from him by illegitimate means, by force or by loss, and so on. And thus we are to observe from this book of Ecclesiastes, and much reference is made to it, the unfairness of the world, which again biases the field against the atheist, against the worldly man in his strife for fulfillment and contentment. That it is simply not a fair game. That it is not a fair world. And thus he has no guarantees, no assurances in the things which he does and the things for which he labours. Now, some examples of this unfairness, we might so call it, are described in this book of Ecclesiastes. And three examples of unfairness in particular. The first of these we might call strife. So here in Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 4, Solomon says this: "Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbour. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit." And coupled with this, the sixth verse: "Better is an handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit." Now let us consider that man, Solomon, or indeed any other worldly-minded man, who seeks to find his fulfillment in the works and labours of his hands. Solomon, of course, did this. He did great works. He accomplished great feats of architecture. He rebuilt Jerusalem and so many other towns in Israel. He achieved great things. Or likewise, the man who seeks to amass himself riches. And this Solomon also did. He was clearly a very astutely, financially minded man. He had a degree of economic diligence and discernment. and he made evidently some very sound choices and decisions for the nation of Israel, which resulted in an almost unprecedented degree of wealth for the land and for himself in particular. Or indeed, the man who seeks fulfillment in wisdom and in learning. To this also Solomon attained in a very great degree. And one cannot say that there is anything fundamentally wrong in such pursuits as those in which Solomon engaged himself and in which he excelled. And so an individual might do in the way in which Solomon did, and think, surely here is the way to happiness and contentment and fulfillment. But what did Solomon find? He considered all his travail and such right and proper works as he has engaged in, and says, for this, a man is envied of his neighbour. Now, doubtless there were many who lauded and applauded Solomon's achievements, many who rejoiced in them, many who basked in a shared or reflected glory in the things which Solomon did in his day, and perhaps there were some individuals who were very pleased for him and very happy for him, and considered it a triumph and an achievement in which they too could rejoice and find some pleasure. But of course, that was not the universal response. And Solomon found, as men and women of the world will inevitably find, that because of the unfairness, the perversion of this world in which we live, that the reaction of many others will be quite the opposite. Envy arises. Covetousness arises. And there are certain individuals, it is almost inherent in the minds of worldly men and women, that when they see the success or advancement or promotion of one individual, they despise them for it. And they hate them for it. And rather than deriving any pleasure in another's good, they rather find only distress, anger, envy at another's good. And there is no accounting for this in the atheist's world view, because it is fundamentally an effect of the fall. It is proof positive of sin's influence in this present evil world. Why should we not rejoice in another's good? Why should we not think it to be a collective advantage or of overall benefit? And yet we do not. Worldly man does not. He sees the success, the advancement, the attainments of another, and immediately he must seek to undermine them, belittle them, mock them, scorn them. And this he very often does, not because he dislikes that individual's attainments, but because he envies them. And he thinks, why should this individual have this or that thing, and I should have it not? Disregarding the fact that maybe it has been attained through labour or travail or hard work or in a right way, that does not matter. He envies it. He is covetous concerning it. And of course, these emotions, which are bad enough in themselves, may give way to other and worse excesses and vices. Envy and covetousness may give way to outspoken abuse or deprecation of the individual, may perhaps be the commencement of a road to theft or violence or trying to take what another has by force. And Solomon himself found this. The account of 1 Kings, and particularly the 11th and 12th chapters, tell us that even whilst Solomon was at the high point and the zenith of his career and his reign, whilst he was still accomplishing those great works in Jerusalem and round about, he had enemies that arose against him. An individual called Rezon, another individual called Hadad, who remembered past grievances which they had with David his father, and that was sufficient grounds for them to be haters also of Solomon. And they were enemies, they were adversaries of Solomon's for the rest of his life. And we may rest assured that they were but an example of many others who felt much the same way. And so, as he saw an increase in these worldly goods which he amassed, so Solomon also saw an increase in strife and contention and animosity from his fellow man, to such an extent that he is caused to make this statement in the sixth verse: better is an handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. He proved, as men and women of the world continue to prove to their cost, that you cannot have it both ways. That you cannot have a multitude of this world's goods and peace. That you cannot have great personal advancement and attainment and prosperity and enjoy quietness and security and peaceable relations with your neighbours, because the one will always come at the cost or at the expense of the other. For no greater or higher reason than the unfairness and perversion of this world in which we live. Better, says Solomon on reflection, to have had less material gain and greater peace and quietness than the other way about. Such is the unfairness of the world, and such the strife which is continual within it. But now another example of the unfairness of the world, and this we might call injustice. Injustice. Now there are several passages in Ecclesiastes which speak of these things. For example, chapter 3 and verse 16, Solomon says, "And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there." And likewise, in chapter 7 and verse 15, he makes this remark: "All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in wickedness." Chapter 8 and verse 14, "There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity." Chapter 10, verse 4, he describes another state of injustice in the world. "If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offences. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth." And likewise, in chapter 8 and at verse 10, he describes this situation: "When one man ruleth over another to his own hurt, and so I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." He recognized the breakdown and the failings of systems of justice which existed within the world, of occasions when those who did well were falsely perhaps charged or prosecuted or suffered through no reason or justifiable cause, or on the contrary, those who did evil, who did wrong, getting away with it, or worse still, being promoted and rewarded when they in fact deserved the opposite. There was a breakdown in justice, in worldly, in earthly legal systems that should have been established for the common good of their citizens. There was a failure of those very systems which brought gross unfairness and inequity. Now, of course, if an individual is seeking to find fulfillment, contentment, happiness in the pursuit of legitimate things, obtaining to get through a right way, through the labours of their hands, a sense of accomplishment, to build up riches in a right way, to live according to wisdom and increase in knowledge and understanding and philosophy and those sorts of things, they run the risk of being undermined in their pursuits by injustice and inequity. A man may seek to be doing a great work, perhaps even as Solomon was, building up the walls of the city and improving it for his own satisfaction, and yet be accused of doing wrong. Think, for example, of Nehemiah, many generations later, who came back to the city of Jerusalem and was striving to rebuild it and to lay again and build up again those walls, Solomon's originals perhaps. And even as he was doing it, he found himself surrounded by detractors and critics and those who were prepared to write back to the authorities in the Persian Empire and accuse him of seeking to set up governments in opposition to those in Persia and to act contrary to the command of Cyrus, to be falsely accused. And if God had not been with Nehemiah, things might so easily have gone in his enemy's way, and he could have been falsely prosecuted and stopped in those things. My friends, this world, blighted by sin, is guaranteed to be unfair. There will be distortions and perversions of government. There will be breakdowns in systems of justice. There will be gross miscarriages of justice. And it is impossible to account for those things. What a terrible hazard this is to the man or woman of the world who seeks to find their happiness in this world and in worldly things, that they cannot guarantee that they will not fall foul of the law or of a miscarriage of justice or of false accusations, have their reputations destroyed, their livelihoods taken away, and to lose out and to fall foul of such things as these. They simply cannot guarantee it. But what about those less legitimate means of finding fulfillment and pleasure and happiness and contentment? Because Solomon tried those as well. He tried living according to folly, contrary to received opinion, contrary to public decency. He wanted to live like that. He wanted to follow pleasures. He wanted a hedonistic existence of carnal enjoyment. He committed gross indecency and scandalized the public by his false and erroneous relationships with so many women. Now, of course, when he was experimenting in those directions, a breakdown of justice seemed to work in his favour. And if he could evade the law, or as was his case as king, to live above the law and in brazen defiance of it, then surely that worked in his favour. Now, an individual might say, well, a breakdown of justice, inequity in worldly legal systems, why, this might favour me. This might help me. If I want to find my fulfilment in pleasures, in carnal enjoyment, in things that are wrong, in things that are prohibited, well, then this will work to my advantage. In fact, better that there were no laws. Better that there was no system of governance. Better if I could live without any sorts of restrictions or requirements imposed by the state or civil government, then I would have what I wanted. Then I would be happy. But of course, those who speak in such a way never follow it through in their thinking, do they? Because if there are no laws, if there are no legal impediments, if there are no restrictions or regulations imposed upon society at large, then every man can do what is right in his own eyes. And one individual might steal and by illegitimate means amass riches to himself by forcibly taking them from one person, only to find that they are thereafter forcibly taken from him. And if everybody is equally anarchic, and if there is no law applying to anyone, then this too works against him. For what he gains by unjust means, what he amasses by illegitimate means, may be then taken from him by illegitimate means. Anarchy would not work for anybody. You see, what that individual who pursues fulfillment and happiness by unjust or illegal means really wants is to be free of the law themselves, while everybody else is bound by it. They want to be uniquely free of restrictions and regulations. They want everybody else to have to play by the rules while they break them all. That is what they want. And of course, we see something of this mindset in the world still to the present day, do we not? There are men and women who are very concerned to increase their own wealth and their own financial state. And they look around in the world and they hear news of big corporations and large global companies who are evading tax. And they think that this is an outrage. And there are protests at these corporations for evading tax and for paying so little returns to the countries in which they are domiciled and so on. And there is a great public outcry about it. And yet, whilst they are condemning others for such practices with one breath, they are doubtless engaged in similar pursuits themselves, albeit on a much smaller scale in their own lives. And if they felt that they themselves could evade taxation or increase their own wealth by somewhat questionable means, then very likely they would engage in it in a moment. I remember even hearing of a Christian church who employed a pastor, a salaried minister, and in the interests of avoiding tax, instead paid half the salary to the man and half to his wife. And my friends, these were people who claimed to be Christians. This was not astute financial practice. This was most underhand manner of conduct. And yet such they did. And such is the hypocrisy and inconstancy in the minds of worldly men. What they really want is to be free of the law themselves, while everybody else has to abide by it. Solomon, alas, saw this himself. He lived above the law, but it did not advantage him. He saw that injustice, that anarchy, that a breakdown in law and order helped no one. And better if he had lived according to its constraints than so foolishly broken from its confines. As we read in chapter 10 on a previous occasion, he that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him, whoso removeth stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. There was great hurt and harm wrought to himself by the breaking of the law and seeking to live outside of it. So there is strife and there is injustice. But injustice may reach a certain pitch and may exceed to such a level that it becomes another and more grievous form of unfairness. And this we will call oppression. Oppression. And of this also Ecclesiastes speaks. Ecclesiastes 4, "So I returned and consider all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. And likewise, in the 13th verse of this chapter, he says, better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished. For out of prison he cometh to reign. He is speaking there of the poor and wise child who may escape the prison of poverty by virtue of the wisdom which he has. Whereas also he that is born in his kingdom, the kingdom of a old and foolish and unadmonishable king, he that is born in his kingdom becometh poor. Poverty and penury caused by the rule of a wicked and intractable monarch. Again in chapter 5, verse 8, if thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. In chapter 10, verse 16, again the same truth is expressed. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. The oppression and the poverty and the distress which is caused by wicked and evil administrations in the affairs of men, by those who are given over to wickedness and by their rule make the lives of their citizens and subject lives of misery and distress. Now we might say, well, really, what bearing does this have on the pursuit of fulfillment and pleasures? Why should the matter of oppression and the wrong treatment of citizens and subjects in various parts be of any concern to the individual who is selfishly bent on their own fulfillment and happiness? Why is there any connection? Why should this be described as an increaser of vanity? Well, my friends, in two particular ways. Because the fact of the matter is that the individual who is selfishly seeking for their fulfillment, for their happiness, seeking to find their purpose in life, very often becomes the oppressor of others. And in their struggle to attain their dreams, their aspirations, treads down so many others in their path. And Solomon, who remarks upon oppression and the wrong treatment of individuals in society, was, alas, himself guilty of behavior of this nature. He, in seeking his own pleasure and his own fulfillment, became an oppressor of other people. And of this we read in the unflinchingly honest account of 1 Kings chapter 11. And we read in 1 Kings 11 verse 26, and Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephrathite of Zeredah, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow woman, even he lifted up his hand against the king. And this was the cause that he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built Milo and repaired the breaches of the city of David his father. And the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing the young man that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. And there then, of course, follows an account of a prophet who came to Jeroboam and foretold the civil war which would erupt after the days of Solomon, and how Jeroboam would become the first king of the 10 northern tribes. Now this doubtless came as a great surprise to Jeroboam, and it was a matter of great distress to Solomon. And word of that prophecy came to Solomon, and in verse 40 we read, Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam. And Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Here was a man who was dutifully and diligently employed in the works which Solomon was constructing in Milo. A man who we read was a servant of Solomon's, was a mighty man, was industrious, and who Solomon had promoted to a position of responsibility over the workers that had come from Ephraim and Manasseh. And this Jeroboam did. And evidently Jeroboam had not had the best of starts in life. His mother, we are particularly told, was a widow woman and therefore dependent upon Jeroboam, doubtless, for her support and maintenance. And no sooner had word of this prophecy come to Solomon than he forcibly exiles Jeroboam, who to this point had done no wrong against him, had not discharged his duties dishonorably, had not forsaken his role as an employee or servant of Solomon's. And yet in the moment that prophecy was made known to Solomon, he wickedly exiled Jeroboam. He was driven as a wanted man and a fugitive to fly to Egypt. And so far as we can see from this account, was thus removed from the support of his own widowed mother. And this Solomon did, you see, in the pursuit of his own fulfillments and those labors he was accomplishing in Jerusalem at the time. This is but one example. How many others, we must wonder, felt the same and were distressed and aggrieved and hurt by Solomon's pursuit of his own happiness. The individual, selfishly bent on their own fulfillment, become very often the oppressors of others. Solomon, even as he amassed his riches and built his great works, could not stop his ears to the tears of the oppressed, to the cry of those who were hurt and injured by that very process. But still, there is another connection between this state of oppression and an individual's search for fulfillment. And it is this. Let us suppose that Solomon had not hurt anyone in seeking to amass riches and find fulfillment. Let us suppose that nobody had been detrimentally affected or negatively impacted by the things that Solomon did. Let us suppose that in a completely honest and just and equitable way, Solomon had got to a position of happiness and fulfillment and wealth and so on. And then in that position of singular blessedness, had looked around him and seen all the evil that was done in the world. And seen that perhaps at his immediate borders on the land of Israel, there were those who wickedly subjugated their citizens, who ruled their subjects with a rod of iron, who incarcerated and immolated their citizens and those whose lot it was to live under their wicked rule. Could any individual enjoy the good which they had amassed, whilst all the while to their ears came the cry of those who were oppressed and distressed and in a state of poverty or penury? You see, that atheistic or worldly man or woman who strives for their own fulfillment and happiness needs to ask themselves this: how would they enjoy it in this present evil world? How could they go about the indulging and the enjoying of those things which they amassed, when they are surrounded by so much ongoing suffering and poverty and unhappiness on the part of others. Because that old adage is true, that no man is an island, no individual can live in a state of complete isolation. And though a person were to obtain and get what they might consider a fulfillment and contentment in this life, they are still under the sun, they are still upon this fallen planet, and the echo of the cry of the oppressed will continually ring in their ears as long as they are here. They might have attained their own goals and objectives in this world, but there are still millions in a state of distress. They have not changed the planet one iota, unless they made it worse in their headlong course and pursuit of their own happiness. They cannot escape the monstrous things which are going on all around them. Though a man may obtain his objective under the sun, he is still under the sun in this scene of unfairness and strife and injustice and oppression, which is doomed to distract him from the enjoyment of his earthly things, which is guaranteed to mar and to spoil that which he has in this life. In conclusion, my friend, let us learn from this somewhat sad and distressing picture of the world in which we live why it is so essential that if we will lay up treasure for ourselves, we lay it up in heaven. Here is proof positive, as Solomon himself found, that one cannot find fulfillment in this present evil world, because it is a present evil world. Because as long as it endures and as long as this sinful state persists, there will be oppression and injustice on every hand. And unless a man were to live a life of a disconnected hermit on some island, he simply could not escape from all the evil that is around him, all the sorrow and sadness that abounds on every side. Who would seek fulfillment here? Who would seek their ultimate happiness here? What folly there is in it! We must aspire for something higher, for something better, for something beyond this scene, under the sun. The fact of the matter is this, Ecclesiastes 3, verse 17. God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. There will be a setting of the record straight. There will be the establishment of perfect justice. There is a day of reckoning, of coming. There is a time of rectitude. If we desire happiness and fulfillment, let us look to that time. Let us look to that point for it. All these things which exist around us now in this world under the sun will be brought to an end, will be ultimately burned up. What manner of persons then ought we to be? As Peter tells us in his second epistle, in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent, that ye may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. May the Lord cause to grow within us this same mind, this attitude, these heavenly aspirations, and ultimately bring us there and fulfill them as we seek it for his name's sake. Amen. Amen. Our concluding hymn, number 811, speaks of that time when these things will be brought to pass, when from heavenly Jerusalem's towers the path through the desert they trace, and every affliction they suffered redounds to the glory of grace. Their look they cast back on the tempests, on fears, on grim death and the grave, rejoicing that now they're in safety through him that is mighty to save. Number 811. Jesus Christ himself and God, even our Father, which hath loved us and hath given us everlasting consolation and good hope through grace, comfort our hearts and establish us in every good word and work. Amen.